It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, an education foundation sued Washington County over its plans to sell the former UW-Milwaukee at Washington County campus to a private Christian school. The foundation argued that its donations over the decades were meant to benefit public education, not private. Across the state, elected officials and higher education leaders are grappling with hundreds of acres of campuses that are now empty, as 8 of the 13 UW branch campuses have closed or downsized since 2023. To get an update on these campus buildings and two-year branches, we have Kelly Meyerhofer with us, who covers higher education for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Before we get into this lawsuit in Washington County, can you tell us about the UW-Milwaukee at Washington County branch campus? What was this campus like and why was it closed?
Yeah, UW-Milwaukee closed it almost 2 years ago due to low enrollment and just financial pressures. They said they couldn't keep operating the campus. UWM also had another campus in Waukesha. They've closed that one too.
Around the state, we have this question coming up as these two-year branch campuses close. What do we do with the land and the building and the stuff? What pre-lawsuit, what was the current plan for this property?
Washington County was planning to sell it to a private Christian school called Ozaukee Christian School. Before that, they were looking into selling it to a national charter network, but there's been a lot of community reaction and protest to these plans to not keep it for public education. So that's something that county officials are grappling with.
I know in some cases around the state, this property is owned by multiple local units of government or other entities. Is this something that it is just the county that's dealing with this? That's one slightly less complicated factor maybe than other parts of the state?
Well, actually, they had sort of co-owned it with the city of West Bend, owned like 26% of it, and the county owned 74%. But then in this lawsuit, part of the complaint mentions that the city of West Bend has transferred its ownership to the county. So now the county is the one that is left dealing with this, and the city is no longer involved in the negotiations.
Okay, now here comes this lawsuit we've been mentioning. Who is the group bringing this suit? What is their claim here?
Sure, it's the Washington County Charitable Foundation. This is sort of the local foundation that would raise money for kids in the area that chose to go to their local UW campus. You know, they raised money. They gave over $1 million for a campus building over a decade ago. Now they're suing because they say that that gift for that campus building was on the condition that this would be for public education, not a private school.
And what have we heard from the county now in response so far to this lawsuit?
Not too much. I mean, when I reached out to them, they just said negotiations of the sale to this private school are still in process. The county attorney has said that they have not yet gotten this $2 million state grant that they are expecting to get. This is a law that was passed several years ago to give up to $2 million to each of the counties or cities that own these campuses and are basically being stuck with this property and what to do with it after UW has closed it down.
Yeah, what kind of strings are attached to that $2 million of redevelopment funding? Again, not just for Washington County. What is that money intended for? Just a, hey, sorry, we made these dead buildings in your property. Here's a little something to help you out.
Yeah, I mean, the law says that the money must be used to enhance the community's economy in some way. So it must facilitate job creation or create more housing or public infrastructure. You know, there's a wide range of uses that it could be used for, but the state agency that's administering this money, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, hasn't responded to me when I've asked, like, have any counties gotten the money or like what is the status of all these grants? So it's sort of unclear how that process is going.
We have this lawsuit, but as you mentioned, there were negotiations on the sale of this property to this Christian school. Where were we on that? How close was that to being finalized and, you know, having stacks of papers signed?
Yeah, I mean, the county board approved negotiating the sale back in August. And then, you know, this fall, this local foundation filed a notice of intent to sue. And that sort of put the wholesale on pause. And part of why, you know, the state agency has said, the county attorney has said that the grant is going to be on ice because the foundation had filed that they were, you know, intending to sue.
I understand there's been some concern over the purchase price that is being negotiated here. What are the are people looking at? What are the concerns there?
Yeah, I mean, the property, the former campus, it was assessed at about $5 million, and the county has negotiated a deal to sell the property for $3 million to the private school. So a lot of critics say, you know, this is far below the asking value. We're not getting a good deal here, and this private school is getting a great deal. The county has justified it by saying, well, if you add the $2 million grant that we're going to get, you know, that adds up to $5 million. But now the grant is sort of unclear if that will be coming through.
Before we move out of Washington County, what are you watching for next? It sounds like there's a lot of different threads going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, you know, this county's sort of case and situation is emblematic of, you know, a lot of the counties across the state that are being saddled with these campuses by UW are still sort of figuring it out years after the closure. And I think it just illustrates that, you know, this is a big deal for these counties. It's an opportunity, but it's also sort of a challenge for some of them where, you know, if they're in a more rural area or they don't have the money to redevelop it, it can be quite a challenge.
We are talking about campus closures and redevelopment plans with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel higher education reporter Kelly Meyerhofer. This all stems from decisions made to close some of the two-year branch campuses around the state and questions, as we're hearing, still unresolved of what happens to that land, what happens to the buildings. Let's move north, Kelly, from Washington County. The UW Fox Cities campus officially closed in June, and selling this property, there's some complications because it's owned by multiple entities here. Who all owned that, and why has that been significant in the story in that community?
Well, actually, Winnebago County now solely owns that campus, but it used to be owned by two counties, and then the one sold it to Winnebago County. So now they're the ones that are solely trying to figure out what to do with it. There was a company, the Faith Technologies company that's based in Menasha. They were exploring, you know, potentially buying it, and they just announced last month that they were not going to move forward. So that's kind of a setback for the Fox Cities area.
Right. There had been a lot of run up to Faith Technologies adding that campus to their campus, in effect, for training and other uses. Now that that rug has been pulled, what are people looking at? Is anybody stepping forward with interest to this that you've seen so far?
No, I mean, I haven't heard, you know, much that's happening. This just happened last month of the company that was interested pulled out. So it's still sort of up in the air what's going to come.
And we've talked on the show, the campus includes the Barlow Planetarium, which has some local support there, and the Weiss Earth Science Museum. There have been hopes over the time since this closure that those could continue on as standalones in some ways. Have you seen any progress on those facilities so far?
The exhibits that were in the Science Museum, they were moved to the History Museum at the castle. And I know the planetarium was reopened last August. I think, you know, it just sort of speaks to the community wanting to keep these sort of public assets that have been available to them for decades, you know, in the community's hands and not to some private developer.
Now turning to Waukesha, the former UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha campus also closed, expected to be converted, the latest I've heard, into a flexible housing development. What are we seeing in those plans so far, Kelly?
Yeah, I think Waukesha has been one of the cases where, you know, they've sort of been very clear of their plan from the beginning. They always said they wanted to turn it into housing, and they're still moving forward with that process. It's just taking a little bit longer than, you know, they said that this was their timeline. And I think the latest shows that they are still hashing out a deal with the developer. And it's, you know, a couple weeks behind what they had estimated, but that's still the plan, is to have some sort of flexible housing development at that former campus.
And do we know what they mean by flexible?
Yeah, I think it's going to be, you know, a variety of housing styles. There's going to be some affordable housing, some sort of more luxury housing, just a mix on that 60-year-old campus.
And this is a partnership, as you hinted, between the county and a developer. But because it's the county, because they have hopes for how this works out, it sounds like there's a little more say, a little more strings attached for that developer. Is that part of what's delayed things a little bit so far?
I don't know about strings attached. I think, you know, sometimes government just works slower than, you know, the officials want it to.
Now, you've been reporting on higher education campus closures in a variety of communities. What has been the tone from the people, the local decision makers who live in these communities, to seeing these institutions now going away and needing to be replaced by something else?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, some of the communities, you know, I mean, whenever the campus closure announcement comes, there's a lot of sadness. There can be some anger directed at UW. They feel like UW is just sort of abandoning this property and, you know, cutting ties with any sort of responsibility that they've had over decades. In some places, you know, like I feel like Waukesha, they've sort of moved on and they've gotten over the pain and they're moving forward with a housing plan. And then I think there's places like Richland County, which was the first campus to close. It's in rural western Wisconsin. There's not a lot of educational opportunities around other than this campus that now closed. And so there's a lot of resentment that lingers. I was actually driving through Richland County a couple weeks ago for a different assignment, and I passed by the campus, and you know, the sign is still there, but the lettering has been taken off. And I mean, it's just sort of a ghost campus and this reminder of what the community has lost. And that still hurts for them.
Kelly, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Kelly Meyerhofer, higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a lawsuit against Washington County related to its sale of the former UW-Washington County campus and other fallout from the closure of two-year campuses around Wisconsin. Coming up, reaction from the towns of Peshtigo and Campbell on the potential for tens of millions of dollars to clean up PFAS chemicals.
It's a great step forward. You know, I tell people it's really a baby step.
Every community is really unique, and it's not a one-solution-fits-all type of equation.
Fighting forever chemicals in Wisconsin, that's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Some candidates for Wisconsin Supreme Court are cautious about talking politics. But for liberal appeals judge Chris Taylor, political advocacy is a big part of how she got here. It's drawn contrast between Taylor and her opponent, and in an unusually quiet campaign, it might also draw voters to the polls. WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk has this profile.
Over the last few years, voters have gotten used to high-profile Wisconsin Supreme Court races. There's another race this year, but with the ideological balance of the court not up for grabs, the spotlight is missing. There are still two candidates from different ideological camps. Appeals Judge Marie Lazar of Brookfield is the conservative, and the liberal is Appeals Judge Chris Taylor of Madison.
And I am running because, like so many of you, I care about our democracy, and I care about our individual rights and freedoms. How many of you care about those things? Yeah. All right.
That's Taylor at a recent campaign event at a Steelworkers Union Hall in Neenah. Taylor has been a judge since 2020 and a lawyer for way longer than that. But in between finishing law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and being appointed to the Dane County Circuit Court bench, Taylor was a progressive advocate. She worked as the policy director at Planned Parenthood and then spent nearly a decade in the state assembly, where she was deeply critical of Republican Governor Scott Walker's agenda.
Right to work is not about freedom. It does not make workers more free. It makes them poor.
Governor Walker and legislative Republicans should not be mandating invasive medical procedures for women.
The absolute epidemic of gun violence.
This is just taxpayer subsidies of religious education so that Governor Walker's biggest contributors can make a buck.
It's not totally unusual for lawmakers to become judges. In Wisconsin, David Prosser was a Republican Speaker of the State Assembly before joining the state Supreme Court, and Lynn Edelman was a Democratic state senator before being nominated to a federal judgeship in Milwaukee. One of Taylor's oldest friends says her background demonstrates precisely who she'd be on Wisconsin's highest court.
Chris is extremely passionate about the things she believes in. Deeply concerned about others.
That's Joey Hoey, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. More than 30 years ago, he and Taylor met at a law school party. Hoey remembers talking with Taylor about her decision to run for the assembly. He said she was weighing how to transition from pure issues advocate to representing a diverse constituency. And he said they had similar conversations when the possibility of becoming a judge first arose.
Like when she made the decision to run in the legislature, she wanted to make sure she was ready for what was going to be a switch. You know, she was going to take off one hat and put on a very different hat. And I think she was very cognizant of the fact that the responsibilities and the role that a judge plays are very different than what an assembly representative plays.
Taylor's legislative background opens her up to attack from the other side, and Lazar's ads have gone after her.
Which agenda do you want on the bench?
Former Planned Parenthood policy director and activist Chris Taylor wrote the extremist legislation in 2017 to allow abortion.
But the ads are reaching fewer people this year. Donations are way down, and Lazar's fundraising has lagged. And what voters want from judicial candidates has changed, according to Charles Gay, a professor of judicial conduct and ethics at Indiana University's School of Law. In a place like Wisconsin, where Republicans run the legislature, voters see the courts as another way to accomplish their policy goals.
You know, now it's really you're our last hope. No one is listening to us.
Back at the campaign event in Neenah, Taylor says regardless of the jobs she's held, her values have remained clear.
But the through line in my career for those last 30 years has been that passion and that commitment to people.
Taylor argues that she's a better judge because she was a legislator. In a quieter kind of election, it just might be what she needs to stand out. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
WPR aired a profile of Taylor's opponent, Judge Maria Lazar, yesterday. You can read profiles of both candidates at WPR.org. Last week, the state legislature passed two bills aimed at addressing PFAS contamination across the state. $133 million would be used to create a PFAS trust fund, in part for communities to deal with what are known as forever chemicals. PFAS chemicals pose serious health risks and have been found in many areas of Wisconsin. The bills now head to Governor Evers, who's expected to sign them into law. We turn to two communities that are being affected by PFAS contamination. Trigvi Rood lives in the town of Peshtigo and is a board member of the advocacy group Save Our Water. Peshtigo has been grappling with PFAS contamination in hundreds of private drinking wells from the nearby firefighting foam manufacturer Tyco Johnson Controls. And Lee Donahue is Health, Education, and Welfare Supervisor for the town of Campbell. Campbell shares French Island with the La Crosse Regional Airport. The town first learned about PFAS contamination in its drinking wells in 2020 from firefighting foams at the airport. They both spoke with Kate Archer-Kent on Friday.
Trigvi, starting with you, your town of Peshtigo has known about PFAS contamination in water since at least 2017, and you've been dealing with the consequences ever since. What is your reaction to the state making this move to open up funding for cleaning up PFAS pollution?
It's a great step forward. You know, I tell people it's really a baby step. There's a lot more to do beyond releasing $125 million in funding, which really doesn't amount to a lot when you talk about the scope of this problem.
So a baby step. What will this package be able to do for your community of Peshtigo, do you think?
Probably the biggest impact would be roughly $35 million that is set aside to help provide wells for individual homeowners. The fact that there is no groundwater standard for PFAS leaves about a third of the state residents without any backing as far as the contamination of that in your well. So with this bill, at least some of the folks that are not getting a well provided by the responsible party up here, they now hopefully will have an option to tap into some of that state funding for new wells.
Lee, turning to you, Town of Campbell, how do you see the potential impact of these bills for your community and the passage of this package to address PFAS?
Sure. So for the Town of Campbell, one of our biggest concerns, as well as many of the other PFAS-impacted communities across the state, is how can we best assist residents? And there is money that is set aside in this bill for residents to potentially get reimbursed for the drilling of a new well or connection to a lateral, to a municipal system, or potentially even money to abandon their old wells so you don't have to worry about the risk of cross-contamination. And that's one of the biggest benefits of this bill to our community. But, you know, every community is really unique, and it's not a one-solution-fits-all type of equation.
You are a close-knit community. You talk with your neighbors. Do you think that you would see people in your area go after this type of funding, this type of grant program?
Well, when I've spoken with the DNR, we've had conversations about how can we best assist residents through the application process. We have roughly 1,600 households in the Town of Campbell, which is similar to the Town of Peshtigo and so many other communities across Wisconsin. So putting together an application that would be easy for residents to navigate would really be beneficial. And so we're in some of those very preliminary discussions right now.
Trigvi, what are your thoughts on navigating a grant program and people in Peshtigo doing the same?
Obviously, the typical individual homeowner has a real hard time with navigating any of this sort of thing. The entire PFAS problem we've had here, a lot of us that belong to the group SOH2O have tried to help residents on an individual basis as much as we could. The DNR not having the bodies to help is going to be an issue for sure. Even if they do get 10 additional positions as the bill is proposed, there's still going to be a shortage of employees to help navigate this, help folks navigate this situation.
Mm-hmm. Lee, the legislation covers expenses for bottled water for residents in PFAS-contaminated regions. You know, you have years, you know, with bottled water. This is, you know, millions of dollars in bottled water over the last several years. Is bottled water a cost that your area residents are still dealing with? And could this offset some of this funding, these costs?
So the Town of Campbell has been under a Department of Health issued health advisory since 2021. So mm-hmm. our residents have not been impacted by the cost of that water. The cost of the water has been provided by the DNR. However, once we connect to our new municipal water system, that will free up tons of money for the DNR to be able to assist other PFAS-impacted communities.
I see. How about for you, Trigvi? Is the cost of bottled water an issue for your community?
The responsible party, JCI Tyco, has been supplying bottled water to the folks that are in the area they consider they created the problem for. So mm-hmm. a person like me who is in that area, I've been getting bottled water since 2017. There is an expanded area outside where JCI has claimed responsibility for that the state, the DNR, is providing bottled water for folks that have contaminated wells. So we've been lucky in a sense that we're taken care of with bottled water for all those impacted by PFAS. But again, it's been a huge burden on the state to supply that water. So again, additional funding will certainly help.
We're talking about bills aimed at addressing PFAS contamination now on Governor Evers' desk. Trigvi Rood is with Save Our Water, a board member in the town of Peshtigo. Lee Donahue is supervisor for the town of Campbell. Lee, turning to your community, your town secured nearly $40 million in funding from the USDA to install a municipal water system and deliver, water for residents. Where are these plans now?
Sure. So it's been a long process, and the USDA funding is a part of many funding sources that we've been leveraging to build our municipal water system. We built our first municipal well a couple of months ago, and we are going to be drilling the second municipal well just so we have redundancy. Obviously, if one needs to be worked on, you need to have a backup. And then we will continue with our treatment pump house and our elevated storage. So we are currently working with the Public Service Commission to make certain that we have all of our construction authorizations to continue moving forward. Our goal was to begin piping to homes at the end of this year. I think there might have been a slight delay with some of the work with the PSC, but I believe we're making progress now.
Wow. I mean, the idea of having PFAS-free municipal wells flowing to people's taps in Campbell, that will be a turning point, I would imagine, for your community.
Oh, it's something that we've been waiting on since it was first identified here in 2020. So that's all that everyone really wants. They want to have a safe source of water. They can walk over to their faucet, they can turn it on, and they can safely consume what comes out.
Trigvi, your organization, Save Our Water, it has been advocating for a groundwater standard that's not part of these bills. What is next for your group in pushing for groundwater standards and for, you know, working on this major health issue of PFAS?
We're very happy to have worked with State Representative Jeff Mersaw on getting the bill that was passed, very bipartisan approved. It took a long time to make that happen. When we went into this and first contacted Representative Mersaw, our only ask was to get a groundwater standard set. That's what we really wanted. Unfortunately, like I mentioned, it's not in this bill. So that's where our next push has got to be, to get a groundwater standard set for everybody in the state of Wisconsin that depends upon their private drinking water well. So that's where we're looking at this point.
The bill, it includes liability protections for innocent landowners. Trigvi, what do you make of those protections?
That was quite a battle working with Representative Mersaw, the Republicans and Democrats, the industry lobbyists, the DNR, to come up with something that made everybody, I'll say, happy. Some of those folks aren't as happy as others, but I think it was a good compromise. This issue is huge. I mean, now they'll exempt farmers from dealing with contamination caused by the spread of biosolids from treatment facilities. So, okay, they're exempt from cleaning it up. They still may have the issue of their cow's milk having PFAS in it. So this just grows. It's just exponential on the impacts of this. But the bill is a great start.
Lee, what comes up for you on the protections for innocent landowners?
Trigg's right. This bill is a first step. We understand that farmers who have spread biosolids and the sludge and all of the things that go along with the various ways land and water can be contaminated, honestly, until we get non-essential PFAS out of our manufacturing and the manufacturing cycle, we're just going to be in a situation where we keep rearranging PFAS from one source to another. And I think that one of the next steps is also, in addition to establishing a groundwater standard, is to start banning PFAS in non-essential use. It's one thing to have it as part of a piece of equipment in the state lab where nobody is going to lick it or ingest it. It's another thing to put it in things like feminine hygiene products and diapers and suntan lotion and cosmetics and contact lenses. There's no reason for PFAS to be in those items, and we need to reduce PFAS in our environment just overall and follow the lead of our neighboring states of Minnesota and Michigan.
Hmm. Turning to you, Trigvi, with the situation in Peshtigo, what are your next steps?
I think, again, that groundwater standard is extremely important. Again, I mean, we've certainly talked about the issue of banning PFAS and the use of a lot of products. We have states on each side of us that have done this already. So it's time Wisconsin steps up and works on that as well. The other thing, you know, we're concerned about our residents that are outside of the area that JCI Tyco is not taking responsibility for. Within the responsible area, they are putting in deep wells for individual homeowners. They've put in like 150 deep wells to get down below where the PFAS groundwater is contaminated. So most of us are being taken care of in that manner. But again, it's looking out for our neighbors who don't have that option of a free well from the responsible party. So if we can help them navigate again and hopefully get some of this funding, that's certainly something we'll look forward to doing.
Well, Lee and Trigvi, thank you so much for your time on this issue.
Absolutely.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the invitation.
Trigvi Rood is a resident of the town of Peshtigo and a board member of the advocacy group Save Our Water. Lee Donahue is health education and welfare supervisor for the town of Campbell. They spoke with Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, the creator of the web series Tiny Cabin Life shares his wilderness adventures in remote areas of the upper Midwest and some love for Wisconsin landscapes.
There's so much to explore from, you know, way up in the North Woods to the Driftless region, you know, with all the bluffs and everything in between.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Imagine being in a tent or a tiny cabin in a remote area of Wisconsin with a howling blizzard outside. That might sound fun to you, or maybe it doesn't, but it might be cool to watch somebody else do it. Jack Stewart camps in some of the most remote places in the upper Midwest for a living, bringing viewers up close to the rugged landscapes in Wisconsin and beyond. Jack's the creator of Tiny Cabin Life, a YouTube channel with 340,000 subscribers, following his travels from Brule River State Forest in Douglas County to overnight stays in the Gordon Fire Tower near the St. Croix River. The Minnesota-based videographer and camper often travels to sites without electricity or running water with his golden retriever, Ellie, cooking meals over an open fire or wood-burning stove. Here he is exploring the North Country Trail in northwest Wisconsin.
The boardwalk here is an experience in and of itself. It's just so, like, tranquil hearing our footsteps on the wood and the way it just carves this path through the forest. It almost has like a mystical quality to it. It's very, very surreal.
His videos are part cozy travelogue and part nature documentary of the upper Midwest, Lake Superior, the North Woods, the Driftless, and the feet of snow that could blanket those landscapes. Jack is with us now. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting.
You've camped all over, really. You've done TV work in national parks around the country. I think nationally people might think, wait a minute, the upper Midwest? What is there to offer there when you've been all over like that? Well, you found a lot. Sell us on that.
Yeah, you know, I used to actually think that. When I moved out of Minnesota, that's where I'm from, to go to college in Montana, I thought I would never be back. Not that, you know, I would always visit, but I never thought I would live here again. And then life brought me back, as it does a lot of us, back to the Midwest. And since I have gotten here, I have gotten to know just the beauty of this region like never before. And there is so much here that we really have to offer. And there's so much to explore from, you know, way up in the North Woods to the Driftless region, you know, with all the bluffs and everything in between. It's been really, really cool to get to take a real deep dive into that.
And some of the stuff you do watching your videos, I don't know if people would call it extreme exactly, but it is not casual camping. What is it that appeals to you about being in a remote place, sometimes in quite difficult weather, or being bitten by all the flies, or whatever the case might be?
Yeah, you know, I think remote places and nature itself, it really helps you to be present in the moment. You know, when you're dealing with the brutal cold or the mosquitoes or whatever, or even just like a hike where you have to reach your destination, you're locked in. And I just have found that it's such an awesome way to disconnect from everything that, you know, is either going on in the world or in our personal lives, just for a little bit, to be able to kind of find just like a little different perspective on life and get out there and find that silence and that peace and really have an experience. And so that's what's always drawn me in. And you also create incredible memories with the people you're out there with. So whether it's my family, friends, or of course my dog, there's just so many incredible memories that you make when you're out in these places.
That said, I saw on your website you've helped people design glamping experiences and setups. I don't get the sense that you're really judgy, like, oh, if you're not out there in the middle of nowhere roughing it, you're not really camping. You seem pretty inclusive as to what the joy of experiencing camping, however we want to do it.
Totally. I mean, that's the thing is, however you get out there, it's going to be awesome and you're better off getting out there. So if people want to go out in an RV, I think that's amazing. It's so nice to have, you know, a nice comfy bed. Even my little cabins, being able to close the door and lock it at night. I mean, a lot of times that really adds a sense of comfort. But again, if you're the type of person that wants to get out and you know, use a tent or survival shelter, however hardcore you want to go, it's awesome. It's just about being out there and having fun.
You're from Minnesota, as you mentioned. You've got some pretty nice scenery over there, I'll grant you. You've done a lot of your work, though, in Wisconsin, too. What are some of the most memorable landscapes you spent time in over here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, I think Wisconsin, what I've really come to love is the Brule River area that dumps into Lake Superior. Just kind of all over in that region, it's so beautiful. I mean, having trout streams like that are just so pristine. I mean, you can catch probably as many, if not more, trout than you can out west in that river. But also the scenery there, you know, you're kind of up in the North Woods, you have the shore of Lake Superior, but then not too far away from there even, you get into like the St. Croix territory, which is gorgeous. And actually, one of my favorite places is the Old Gordon Fire Tower, which is this awesome tower that's up on this, you know, well, it's, yeah, it's this old fire lookout on this massive tower, and you're overlooking the St. Croix, and you can actually rent that place out. And it's such a cool way to get to experience that area, kind of get a bird's eye view, and something that you really don't get too often in the Midwest, being able to stay in one of those lookouts. It's super cool.
You know, talking to you, I get the sense, and I get this in your videos too, you've done a lot of camping. And you know, you're videoing it. I could see some people think, oh, this is a chore. I'm doing this bit again. You are clearly still loving this and excited about it. What is it that keeps you coming back and having the smile as you remember these landscapes?
I really enjoy like getting out maps and like looking for the next adventure. There's something that's just so like fulfilling to me about like trying to plan out the next trip, where I want to go, what I want to see, how I want to camp there, whether it's, you know, recently I just put up a teepee. Like I literally had to cut down poles and wrap canvas around it. I just love coming up with these adventures and then getting out there and seeing if I can pull them off. And then also, I have a TV background. I love capturing it too. I love, you know, bringing my cameras out. And that's even part of the challenge as well. It's like, how can I capture this and make people feel like they're there with me? So all that together is just so exciting and fun for me. And it is taxing. It's tiring, you know, but that's also part of the fun too. And you just feel so accomplished when you either, you know, finish a hike or spend the night out in the cold or put together a video. Just all of that together is just, it's really fulfilling. And I do really enjoy it.
You mentioned the teepee, and you also earlier mentioned the tiny cabins that you are building yourselves. How did you get started on that, and what goes into creating a nice tiny cabin to camp in?
Yeah, so the tiny cabins came from my love of our family cabin up in the North Woods here in Minnesota. It's not a tiny cabin, although it's not huge, but I just grew to love, like, just being in a cabin, you know, the smell of the wood and of course the outdoors and having a fire and the wood stove or the fireplace. And I was living in California at the time and I was like, I want something like this. So I actually bought a tent that I sort of brought a bunch of gear into and even a little fire and tried to make it feel like a cabin. And I called it my portable cabin. Well, anyway, when I moved back here to Minnesota, I said, I'm going to build a cabin. And the only real thing that I had no camp building experience. So the only real thing I could do was build a tiny cabin because it was like a bite-sized, you know, opportunity to build a cabin. And then from there, I just grew to love building and finding ways to have a cabin wherever I want to take one. So now I have a cabin on wheels, you know, on a trailer. That's definitely tiny. I have a bike cabin. I literally tow it behind a bicycle. I have a boat cabin. So I built a little cabin on top of a boat. And then I've got a little A-frame. And so it's just become this fun thing of figuring out how I can bring cabin life really anywhere I want.
We're talking to Jack Stewart, creator of Tiny Cabin Life on YouTube and elsewhere, talking about some of his favorite places, the things he likes to do in Wisconsin and around the upper Midwest. Let's talk about the video series, Tiny Cabin Life. Now, if people haven't seen it, they might be thinking, oh, you whip out your phone, right? And you shoot little videos. There's production. As you mentioned, you're a TV guy. What goes into producing these videos that, again, are more than just somebody with their phone waving it around?
Yeah, I really take pride in trying to present these adventures in the highest quality possible. And so a lot of times what that looks like is I have my, you know, bigger camera. It's really only like a camcorder, honestly, but I have my bigger camera that I use to capture the really beautiful scenery or, you know, myself and my dog hiking down the trail, those types of shots. And then I have a smaller camera, you know, basically like a little GoPro that I use for like hiking through the woods and stuff. But I make sure to get all the different angles and really try to bring viewers in. And then I use my drone, you know, to get the big scenics and do some other little tricks with that. But essentially, I just try to use the different tools that I have to kind of put the puzzle together to really, make something that makes people feel like they're there, is beautiful to look at. And it's really just knowing how to use those different things and cut them together to make it enjoyable.
And obviously, people like to watch this. You've got a pretty good following. Looking in the comments, seems like you've got a feeling of community there. What is it that has people, apart from the video production quality, what is it, do you think, that people enjoy about sharing this experience with you?
I think just disconnecting and having an escape, you know, from whether it's stuff going on in the world or their day-to-day lives, or just finding time to relax at the end of the day. A lot of people say they really like to relax with it. So, you know, being able to just sit there with the flicker of the fire and hearing the sound of the fire and watch the wind blowing through the trees. I really try to let shots breathe. So I let you kind of sit in moments instead of like jumping, you know, from one thing to the next. And so I think people really like just taking that breath of fresh air. And, you know, if they can't get out there themselves, they're able to experience that through Tiny Cabin Life.
A lot of watching your videos is pretty chill and I think relaxing. There have been moments, though, that look a little tougher. What have been some of your most difficult experiences along the way as you're putting together the series?
Yeah, you know, there've been a few. It depends what I'm doing. So a lot of times, you know, these remote backcountry cabins that I go to, those can be a lot more challenging because I have to hike all my gear in there, so to speak. And so one that I can think of was right outside Lake Tahoe. I had to climb up, I think it was a couple thousand feet of elevation, but they had just gotten, you know, I think a couple feet of snow. And I decided for whatever reason not to bring my snowshoes on the trip. And so I was just like sinking into this snow and I had to climb up this mountain to the summit. That was really tough. And so there's a lot of things like that, or even just like, you know, these last couple of weeks I've been out there and I've been pulling this sled with all my gear behind me through the snow. It's a lot of work. And so, you know, it's a lot of moments like that, or moments in the cold, you know, where maybe the shelter or the cabin's not holding up as well as you want it to, or it's like really cold. Those moments can be a little tough as well. But I will say I'm kind of doing a little dive into some survival type camping lately and some bushcrafting stuff. And so it's getting a little more difficult, but it's been fun as well.
Now, if people hear this or watch your videos and think, yeah, I want to up my camping game a little bit, and they've not been big campers, or they just do, you know, outside of their car camping, which is great too. They want to take it up a level. What is your advice? What are the things that people need to think about that they might not before they take that plunge?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good next step for anyone who's just doing normal car camping or camping in a campground would be to go on just a simple backpacking trip. And the beauty of it is there are places where you could just hike in a mile, even a half a mile, and just kind of dip your toes into the pond, so to speak. And I think that's a great way to get started doing something that's a little more outside of your comfort zone. You'll have to pack all your gear in a backpack. I would just say, you know, make sure you don't bite off more than you can chew. Make sure that you have the things that you need, primarily, you know, shelter, as much warmth as you're going to need. So a good sleeping bag and water. You know, if you have those three things and you're just going out for a night, you'll do fine.
Looking toward the future, are there Wisconsin sites on your list to check out for the first time or maybe revisit?
Of course. Yeah. I've been really enjoying going into Wisconsin because I think especially northern Wisconsin, it's so close to obviously the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, it touches it. So you guys tend to get some pretty wild weather and some deeper snow up there. And so I've been really kind of looking and scouring the maps, finding the new spots that I want to go to. And so that whole area up, you know, I think the closest town is Mellon, Wisconsin, if people know where that is. That's becoming kind of a new hub for me. So I'm looking at a ton of different sites over there on the North Country Trail. And then certainly I want to get down more into the Driftless region where you have all the bluffs and trout streams and whatnot. But between those two, you know, north and south, I'll definitely be back in Wisconsin.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Jack Stewart is an outdoors enthusiast and the creator of Tiny Cabin Life, a YouTube channel with nearly 350,000 subscribers. It chronicles his trips staying in remote areas of the upper Midwest. Many feature Wisconsin, and often they feature his golden retriever, Ellie. After that conversation about spending time outdoors, we want to hear from you. Have you been enjoying Wisconsin's wilderness this winter, from short hikes to a cabin stay, tiny or otherwise, or even full-on winter camping? Or now that the calendar is officially into springtime, where are you looking forward to spending time outside? What kind of activities do you have in mind? Share your outdoor Wisconsin experiences from the last winter or the plans for spring and summer. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. The number either way is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa and Joe Tarr. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.